to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 9th of November, 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the start of another week, and that means we are going to look back over the week's news from the British vantage point, and we also have with us today Max Musson from Western Spring to help us with that. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Oh, hello there. I'm absolutely fine. I've just been a little bit disappointed over the last weekend, though, with the way in which Remembrance Sunday has been treated as a result of lockdown, and the fact that at the cenotaph, the number of people that appeared at the cenotaph was very sparse indeed. It was just the fewest number of people they could assemble in the cenotaph without actually completely cancelling the event. And I was particularly annoyed about the fact that a number of local sort of police services had indicated that if people held their own spontaneous Remembrance Sunday services at the actual war memorials across the country, that would be regarded as an illegal gathering. And the fact that the collections that are made for the charitable collections that are made each year through the sale of poppies, that they must be massively down this year, because I struggled to find somebody that was selling a poppy this year, and I would imagine that lots of people have just not bought poppies, and so therefore the British Legion, who are the main benefactors of that, will probably have their coffers much lower this year than they would have been in previous years. And so it's quite sad, really, that the people who benefited from the sacrifices that were made in the Second World War are too afraid to stand within 6 foot of somebody else, even if they are wearing a mask for just a few minutes. And yet the people who made the sacrifice for them 70, 80 years ago, or whenever it was, those people were expected to have sufficient courage to be able to, in many cases, charge an enemy position, even though it meant their almost certain death, to charge enemy machine gun posts and things of that sort. And yet the people who, as I say, who are the beneficiaries of that bravery are made to look foolish by the authorities, because it makes it appear as if our people are too scared to go out into the street, even just for a few minutes with masks on, to brave this autumn weather in order to pay homage to the sacrifice of our brave soldiers of the past.
Yeah, I think I usually have people coming round selling poppies. I always buy poppies, and nobody's come around this year. And I heard that they've been told not to do that because of the COVID. So there must be masses of funds that they're actually missing out on because of this. And really, I mean, it's really been overshadowed by what's been happening with the American election. And we will have to talk about that a little bit today, even though we want to concentrate on the British news. And I know you've got particular insight into the electoral process there, Max. But before we really get into that, we should make mention of Boris Johnson. And he has congratulated Joe Biden as if he has already been crowned the president-elect, which, of course, he hasn't been. It's only the mainstream media that are saying that. None of the actual races have finished counting yet. There is ongoing court cases that contest this. I guess you could call him the contested president-elect. I mean, it really just shows that the deep state and the new world order, it really is global, because I think a lot of this trying to push Biden forward is because he claims to be Irish rather than American, and apparently he has a lot of support for the Republic of Ireland, and he's going to put a spanner in the works with Brexit by saying that anything that puts a border in Northern Ireland, that would be it. We would have no trade deal with America. So he is quite clearly the globalist candidate. He is quite clearly going to be used to try and put a stop to Brexit, basically, so we can see that the same people that want to stop Brexit are the same people that want to stop Trump. We can see that the mainstream media is working in unison with the puppets, like Boris Johnson, like the other puppets that are congratulating Biden on winning this election, even though he hasn't won an election. I mean, they weren't congratulating Al Gore in 2000 when that was contested. And the actual evidence of fraud is phenomenal. There is just so much evidence of fraud, hundreds of thousands of ballots that weren't actually observed. You can actually see on the graphs that there's where there have been ballot dumps, where 130, 150,000 ballots all for Joe Biden have been dumped into the system in order to raise up Biden above Donald Trump, closing down the counting stations, telling everybody to go home, and then suddenly loads more ballots appearing from somewhere and the ballots continuing to be counted with nobody there to observe it. I saw Giuliani's press conference the other day. That left me feeling very, very optimistic. And he was pointing out that it's only the mainstream media that have actually crowned him. And I think what they're doing is they're going to rush this through. They're going to say it's all done and dusted, so that by the time it gets to the Supreme Court and all the fraud comes out, the Supreme Court will then have to weigh up, even though there's been all this fraud, if we make the election, annul the election, what will the response be? Well, there could be civil war on the streets. So I think that's what the game is that they're playing. They're trying to make it so that even when all the fraud does come out, it's going to be impossible to unseat Joe Biden. That's why they're rushing into this. That's why they're saying that he's the president-elect. And I think it's absolutely disgusting of Boris Johnson's to be playing along with that and to be playing along with the mainstream media when there are court cases. This isn't done and dusted. But I know that you've got a lot of insight in particular into the electoral process, Max, and all the chances that there are for fraud. And I'm guessing the American system is pretty similar to the British system. We've had lots of problems with postal ballots here, particularly by the Labour Party in Tower Hamlets. But what are your thoughts on this? And also, what are your insights on the electoral fraud here?
It's a mistake for Boris Johnson to congratulate Biden at this early stage. Had it not been the United States of America, had it been a small country that was of lesser significance to Britain, then he perhaps could have taken that gamble. But I think that in view of the importance of the United States to Britain, and particularly with regard to a post-Brexit trade deal, then it was a foolish move on Boris Johnson's part. I seem to recall perhaps about 6 months or so back, there was an election in a South American country that was contested, and the international community, to give them that word in inverted commas, the international community placed a great deal of pressure on the, I think, probably more right-wing candidate, and did a very similar thing to what they're doing here with Biden, where they effectively all announced that they were accepting the globalist candidate, and eventually the right-wing candidate backed down and was intimidated into silence. And I think that that may well be what they're aiming to do with Donald Trump, although I think they'll probably get a different reaction from Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump is the sort of person who is likely to fight to the bitter end. As far as the American electoral system is concerned, I've got no direct experience of that, but I do have a fair bit of experience of the nuts and bolts and the workings of the British electoral system. And I've been saying for years that the electoral system in this country has become extremely sloppy, and sloppy to the extent that that it is wide open for electoral fraud to take place. And this is a product of perhaps a two-party system, because there's been a two-party system in the United States for as long as anybody can remember. There's been a two-party system really here in the UK for as long as anybody can remember, as far as general elections are concerned. You know, occasionally there's been the old nationalist candidate or nationalist party that's made some inroads, and occasionally the Liberal Party have been able to return a larger number of MPs to Parliament, but these are effectively only sideshows, and it's effectively been a two-party system between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party ever since the early 1900s, really. And because of that, what we find is that the local authorities who organise the logistics of elections in local areas all the way across our country. And I'm sure it's the same in the United States, where it will be the state authorities that will organize the local elections and the ballots that will take place and where the polling stations are and all that sort of thing. They become used to doing the same thing over and over again. It just becomes like a 4-year cycle that every 4 years we have a candidate stands and we do this and we do that. And everybody's pretty chummy, really, because Tweedledum isn't that different from Tweedledee. And so we don't really mind if Tweedledum or Tweedledee gets elected. And so therefore we're pretty relaxed about it, and we won't go to the bother of having to ensure the security and the integrity of the election. But if you have a look at the rules governing electoral practices in this country, and I would imagine that a similar set of rules probably exists in the United States. Just to give you an example, just starting at the very bottom with an individual polling station, of which there will be several in any constituency. If you have an individual polling station, then that polling station will be manned by a polling officer and probably two or three of his staff. And they will be there to assemble the polling paraphernalia, to get the ballot boxes out, to check the ballot boxes, to put the lids on them, and to have all of the polling slips there ready to hand to people as they come in, and to tick off the person's name off of the electoral register as they come in to vote, you know, who's voted and who hasn't. But the point is that part of the rules are that the candidates in any election are able to appoint polling agents, and the polling agents are able to go to the polling station and have admittance to the polling station before the public are allowed in at the beginning of the morning. And the reason for that is so that the polling agents can see and testify to the fact that the ballot boxes are empty at the beginning of the day. Because otherwise, if nobody checked the ballot boxes were empty, then the ballot that you could start the ballot with a polling station where a ballot box is already half stuffed full of bogus polling slips that have been put in there by the polling staff, if the polling staff happen to be corrupt. And yet, whilst the polling agents are able to check the ballot boxes, they very rarely do. And they are very rarely given the opportunity to. And they do it so infrequently that most of the people who are appointed as polling agents don't even know that they have the right to inspect the ballot boxes. And so I've turned up when we've had nationalist candidates standing and I've been acting as a polling agent for them. I've turned up to a polling station and then initially been denied the ability to enter the polling station and to inspect the ballot boxes by the polling officer, who's then telephoned his boss and then found out that, oh, yes, I am allowed to do that. So then he lets me in. But then the other candidates, polling agents, very often wouldn't have bothered to do that. And they would have just stood there like lemons whilst the polling was organised around them, and they would have had zero input. And also, not only do you check that the ballot boxes are empty, but then the ballot boxes should be sealed, and the seals that are on the ballot boxes should be individually or uniquely numbered seals, so that nobody can open that ballot box without the person who placed that uniquely numbered seal on there knowing that the ballot box had been opened. And it's very important that ballot boxes aren't opened during the course of the day, because if they are able to be opened and reclosed, then obviously when nobody's looking, somebody can pop the lid open, can stick a load of bogus polling slips in there and then reseal it, and nobody would be any the wiser. And yet one of the elements of sloppiness that now exists in our polling system is that instead of the official seals that are being used to seal the ballot boxes, instead of them being uniquely numbered so they can be checked, they're blank. And the polling agent, the polling officer and the staff who man the polling stations, they have pocketfuls of these because they have to assemble the ballot boxes and put the lids on and then seal them. But they've got pocketfuls of these seals, and I've been in situations where there have been perhaps a dozen seals just loosely laying on the desk by the side of a member of the polling staff, which shows then, because there are 4 seals per ballot box, that they would be able to open and close the ballot box that's next to them 3 times during the course of the day, and nobody would be any the wiser. And so that's an element of of swapping this there. And I've also been in a polling station when a member of the polling staff has actually popped those seals open and opened the ballot box because they felt that the ballot papers inside the ballot box were getting a bit too high and it was getting a bit too full. And so they then pushed down on top of the ballot papers to crush them down. And then they shut the lid again and they put new seals in. Now, that person, I hadn't caught that person actually doing something fraudulent because they hadn't actually tampered with the papers that were in the box, but they could have done, and nobody would have questioned what they were doing. And certainly if I hadn't been there, I'm sure nobody would have questioned what they were doing. And so you can see that even while a ballot box is in a polling station, it is that the level of security, the integrity of the polling system is sloppy to such an extent that an individual polling station, or the result at an individual polling station, could be affected. And the point is that you don't, when you're committing electoral fraud, you don't have to commit fraud in every ballot box in every polling station across the constituency or even across the country. All you need to do is to commit electoral fraud in a minimal number of marginal ballot boxes that are in marginal constituencies or marginal wards, so that you flip those wards. And then what happens is that because those wards have been flipped, it flips an entire constituency. Because that constituency has been flipped, then prejudices the outcome of the entire election. And so it is very important that the staff that are employed in polling stations are extremely careful about how they discharge their duties. I don't know whether you want to come in with anything at the moment, Sven.
Well, just thinking that, I mean, that's before we even get on to the postal ballots, that which is an entirely new system which they're using in America. And what you're highlighting there is that there are already flaws, in particular in the British system, where if somebody wanted to fiddle with it, wanted to add ballots in there, then it's perfectly easy way to do this. And you were saying to me before we went on air that the chances of that happening becomes increased if you've got a constituency that's been Labour for 50 years or 60 years and it's used to being Labour, it's got the same people that are working there all the time, then the temptation increases in order to do something like this, particularly if you haven't got people that are watching over your shoulder. And what we've got in America, you've got where this is going on, where this is all being contested, you've got areas that have been Democrat for 50 or 60 years, and they've been known for corruption. And it's in particular these Democrat-run cities within Republican states that are now holding everything up, that are incapable of counting a few million ballots, when you've got places like Texas and Florida that have got them all done really quickly. So the fact is that there's going to be more temptation for them to actually commit fraud there. And the fact that they've got no observers there either, and everybody there is going to be from the Democratic Party in the first place, that there's more temptation, that there's more likelihood of this occurring. I believe it was something like that you were saying to me before we went on air, Max.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if I just continue the process of polling, at the end of polling day, the slot in the top of the ballot box needs to be sealed. And again, it should be sealed, it should be closed, and then there's a place for seals to be attached so it can't be reopened again. And again, it should be individually numbered seals that are put through there so that slot can't be opened between the polling station and the counting hall. Again, what tends to happen is that it is unnumbered seals that are used routinely to seal those slots. So anybody can open those slots. And then in times of old, it used to be that police cars would arrive at each polling station, would collect the ballot boxes, and those ballot boxes would be taken by the police down to the counting hall, and then they would be deposited there, and they would be kept in the centre of the counting hall until all of the polling observers that have been appointed to act on behalf of each of the candidates have assembled in the hall to watch while they pop the seals off so that everybody can see that these ballot boxes have not yet been opened, and all of the people who are the electoral agents should be able to go forward and check that their individually numbered seals are still on the boxes and yet haven't yet been opened, and they should be able to tick it all off. And then when everybody's happy that none of these ballot boxes have been tampered with, then they should be popped open. But what's happening nowadays is that instead of it being the police taking the ballot boxes to the polling, to the counting hall, what happens is that an individual member of the local authority staff who are manning that polling station, a member of the polling staff there, they will take the ballot box in the boot of their car and they'll drive off. And then at some time later, they will arrive at the counting hall, and they will take a ballot box out of the boot of their car. Now, nobody knows whether that's the same ballot box that left the polling station. We've only got that one person's word for it, that ballot box hasn't been interfered with. That person could have driven home and parked their car and had a cup of tea, gone into their house and had a cup of tea, leaving the car with the ballot box in the back of it. Somebody else could have come along if their car hadn't been locked, because we don't know what the situation is. They could have opened that, taken the ballot box out, put another ballot box in that's full of bogus polling slips that have all been ticked in favour of one candidate. And then that person could then be left to drive that ballot box to the polling station, or to the counting hall rather, and deposit it in there. And what also happens is that as the ballot boxes are delivered at the counting hall, instead of waiting for all of the polling observers to come into the counting hall so that they can all check that the seals haven't been broken and then can witness the ballot boxes being opened, what happens is that the members of staff that work in the counting hall is that they just start popping the seals off. They just do it themselves when nobody's watching, and then they open the ballot boxes and then they tip the ballot boxes out onto the tables, ready for people to come to the tables to start counting. And so there is no way of knowing whether the ballot boxes that reach the counting hall are the same ballot boxes that left the polling stations. I would imagine the majority of them probably are, but it's quite likely that some of them aren't. And there's no way of knowing, no way of checking. And when you complain about these practices to the people who are the returning officers, the person who is responsible for administering the count, they just don't want to know. They just shake their head and say, well, this is the way we've always done it. We've never had any problems in the past. Well, of course, you've never had any problems in the past, because this area has perhaps always returned a Labour candidate for year after year after year after year for perhaps the last 70 years or so. And so nobody has, everybody's always taken it as a foregone conclusion that the outcome of this election is going to be a Labour win. And so nobody's ever challenged the status quo. But when a new candidate comes along, who's a different kind of a person, who gets a lot of support from the public, and who therefore becomes a serious challenger to the political party that was the established political party in that area, then there is then a great amount of pressure on the staff to do things that might pervert the outcome of the election, rather than let this, because the point is that Donald Trump has been demonized very, very sort of severely, and been called a fascist and a Nazi and things of this sort. And anybody who is more right wing than the Democrats in America, or more right wing than the Labour Party here in the UK, they get labelled fascists and Nazis. And the point is that, you know, when the young people who work at these counting halls and things, they don't know that when Donald Trump is being accused of being a Nazi, that that's just hyperbole. They think it's the truth. And when they hear that he's a fascist, they don't think it's hyperbole. They think it's the truth. And so they're under a great amount of temptation to cheat in order to ensure that this horrible, nasty fascist person doesn't get elected. And of course, I'm sure that a certain amount of electoral malpractice does take place. And so we've got a situation there then with where, as far as the counting is concerned, all these ballot boxes have already previously been opened. We don't know necessarily, you know, whether there's even the same number of ballot boxes as there was at the beginning of the evening in all of the different polling stations. There were just ballot boxes, because some polling stations have more than one ballot box. You know, with some polling stations, a ballot box becomes full and it's put to one side and sealed, and another ballot box then is substituted in its place. And so you can't even say, well, let's match the number of ballot boxes to the number of polling stations, because you don't know how many ballot boxes there are going to be there at the end of the day. And the only way that you can know how many ballot boxes there should be there at the end of the day is if each ballot box is sealed and individually numbered, and somebody's got a list of all of those individually uniquely numbered seals, and so therefore knows how many seals they have issued, and so therefore checks the seals against that list. That's the only way you can know whether the ballot boxes and the polling slips have been tampered with. So that's polling on the day. So there's a tremendous amount of scope in Britain today, even with polling on the day, for there to be electoral malpractice. Once you then have postal voting just increases it by an order of magnitude, because what happens with postal voting is that the postal votes are sent out. Nobody checks whether the person who has asked for a postal vote is actually a real person, or is actually that's their the only address that they are registered to vote at. Because I've known situations where a student will go to university in one town and they'll have a postal vote sent to them in that town. They'll also, because they previously lived in a different town, will have had postal votes sent to them, or ballot cards to show that they can go and vote in another town. And so it is only a matter of somebody wants to cheat. If all the students in the country, for example, decided they wanted to cheat, then they could have a polling card that they could register themselves to vote in the town where they go to university, and they could register themselves to vote in the town where they were brought up. And if they've lived in any other towns where they've got homes available to them, then they could do the same thing there as well. And so with postal voting, it becomes the scope for malpractice increases much greater. And the point is that when the postal votes are received, because they are not received all on one day in the way that the ballot papers where people vote in person are all received by the counting system on the same day, because they are spread over a period of weeks, it then means that some of the postal voting slips, the ballot papers, are actually stored for weeks on end. And the point is that I've seen in town halls where the postal voting ballot papers have been opened and put into a box, just an open cardboard box, and then put into a cupboard that's got a simple padlock on it, but a simple padlock that the cleaner of the town hall has got a key to. And so this is hardly keeping the ballot papers in a secure environment. These are in a situation where even the cleaner could come in and tamper with the ballot papers if they wanted to.
Just to point out here as well, Max, what you were saying there about how these ballot boxes, they get taken in, and they should be taken in by the police, and they could just be in somebody's car. I mean, I've seen plenty of videos of these ballot boxes arriving in the middle of the night. I've seen people going to pick up the mail ballots after the actual date of the election, people turning up with ballot slips with no record of who they actually are. So all these same things have been happening in America. And then once the ballots are there, and once they're being checked, the observers are supposed to see each one. I mean, Giuliani was saying that they open up the ballot, they hold it up, one party representative inspects it, another party representative inspects it, and if they both say okay, then it gets checked, and if they say there's a question over that, that goes to one side. And that's what wasn't done in America. Is that the same thing that happens in Britain when you do the actual observing of the count?
Yes, when a ballot paper is unfolded by the person who's counting it, they will look to see whether there is a mark. And people are supposed to put a cross in the box next to the candidate that they want to vote for. If they put a mark anywhere else on the ballot paper, then that ballot paper is invalidated because it's regarded that nobody can tell whether they were voting for that candidate or whether they intended to do something else. So the rule is that if there's more than one mark on a ballot paper, the ballot paper is invalidated. And so it's important that if you're going to vote for a candidate, you only put one cross in the box next to the candidate that you want to vote for. And the ballot papers that are going to be rejected are all kept to one side by the returning officer. And when the count is called, the returning officer will collect together all of the agents of the candidates that are standing, and they will then show them the disputed ballot papers, and they'll say, this ballot paper was rejected. Does anybody have any quibbles about that? And if nobody has any quibbles about it, it's rejected. Then they'll show them the next one and the next one and the next one and the next one. And this is why I used to say to people that if you didn't have a candidate standing in your area that was a nationalist candidate that you would be prepared to support, then you should just write something on the ballot paper so that it's a message to the agents of the other candidates, because you know that ballot paper is going to be shown to all of the agents of all the other candidates. So you can write a message on it if you want to send them a message, then that's the most surefire way of doing it. And you know that they will see it and read it. As far as Britain is concerned, as long as there is only a mark in one square, then it will be a valid ballot paper. I've had a situation where somebody drew, like a little child's house with a path and with smoke coming out of the chimney, and it was all connected up, so there was only one mark on the paper, and it was all within the square, which was for the nationalist candidate, and I insisted that that was counted as a vote for that nationalist candidate, and it was eventually accepted. I've had situations where people have put other marks, where sometimes people will tick, and a tick is normally acceptable. Sometimes people will put other marks that have historical significance, let me say that, as long as there is only one mark, it should be accepted. And I've argued that in those cases, those ballot papers should be accepted as well. But as I say, if there's anything more than one mark on a British ballot paper, then it definitely will not be accepted.
One of the other things that they've been doing in America as well is some states allow you to correct the ballot paper. If they think that they've got an idea of what the person meant, then they're actually allowed to write on it and correct it. I mean, I just find that incredible. You know, it should, as you say there, Max, it should either be accepted or rejected. You don't get to second guess what the person meant and write on the ballot paper what you think they meant. It's just incredible that they would allow that.
If somebody hasn't got the intelligence to be able to read the simple instructions, you know, place a cross in one box next to the candidate that you want. If somebody's not intelligent enough to understand that, they're not intelligent enough to vote, in my view. And so if somebody can't get that right, then their vote should be discounted.
I think there was one of the cities, one of these ones that we're still waiting for the count on, and a third of the people there are illiterate, if you believe the memes, and yet we're waiting on them to decide who will be the next president of the United States. It's fascinating stuff. Do you want to add any more to that, Max? Any more that you want to cover on that, on the election?
No, I think we've demonstrated enough, really, that there is an incredible level of sloppiness in the electoral system here in the UK. It's almost certain that the same level of sloppiness will exist in the United States, because they are, you know, that they're both democracies that have existed over centuries, etc., and have operated effectively two-party states. And so I would be astounded if the situation is significantly different in the United States. So my belief is that if Donald Trump's lawyers do their job right, they will find an immense amount of irregularities that will have taken place, especially when you consider a country the size of the United States. So here we are, you know, with a population five times the population of the UK, with all these different states, 56 states, each with their own separate system. The scope for there to be confusion and for there to be irregularities in all of that is so immense that it wouldn't surprise me if the outcome of all of this is that they order a second election.
I'd like to see that. That's what I would like to see. I think they've got to do that, really. If they want to maintain integrity in the democratic process, then they need to have the election again, particularly in the states where the observers were not allowed to observe the counting. Why would you not want people to observe the counting? I mean, it just seems quite obvious to me that there are all these flaws in the system, and this time around, people have taken advantage of it. They have definitely taken advantage of it, and they've overcooked the goose, basically, by keeping the observers out. Well, let's get
in countries where they have inadequate electoral systems, then the international community, in inverted commas, always insists that they have to have international observers, don't they? And so you find that in a lot of elections in the Middle East or in Africa and places of that sort where it's well known that there's widespread corruption, very often the elections take place with international observers, and those international observers have to agree that they feel that there wasn't any undue amount of corruption before the result of that election is accepted. And I think that we could, because of the bitterness that there is in America. You see, this is another aspect of it, that if you have a country that is a monocultural country, where the country is inhabited solely by the race or the nation of people who established that country and who established the civilization there and who were responsible for the founding character of the country, etc., then all the people who live in that country have got similar hopes and aspirations. They've all got they tend by and large to have similar tastes. They tend to agree on lots of things, and so therefore, as far as democracy is concerned, democracy isn't as hotly and as vexatiously contested as it is once you have a multicultural state. So the slow transformation of the United States into a multicultural society, the slow transformation of Britain into a multicultural society, is going to mean that in all future elections, these elections are going to become that much more vexatiously and vitriolically contested. And there will be, unless something serious is done to put an end to it, there's going to be increased corruption and claims of corruption. And eventually, what happens in multicultural societies, and if you look around the world, this is what you tend to see, is that they descend into bloodbath politics.
They did actually have international observers there. I caught an interview with one of these international observers. There were 100 there, which means less than 2 for each state. They claimed they didn't see any irregularities, and the BBC were saying, well, of course, there's no evidence of any irregularities because we've got these less than 2 international observers in each state. But the actual international observer had the name of it had human rights at the end of the name. So you know that it's an NGO. It's being sponsored by the National Endowment for Democracy from America. It will also be being sponsored by George Soros. So, of course, they are going to say that because their chosen candidate is Joe Biden. This is the way they do these things. They will have international observers, but they'll actually be special interest observers. It's like the international definition of anti-Semitism, which is called international, but was brought up by some particularly partisan Jews in the Holocaust industry. Well, let's change the subject now, Max, and get into our greatest Britons with General Gordon, Major General Charles George Gordon, also known as Chinese Gordon, Gordon Pasha, and Gordon of Khartoum. And we're going to be talking about why he is called Gordon of Khartoum today. We will talk about his interactions with the Islamic State of 1835. Gordon, well let's have a little recap of where we got to last week. We heard how Gordon was made the governor of the Sudan, where he abolished torture and public floggings, and he worked to end slavery. We heard about Gordon's interaction with Mr. Baring from Baring's Bank, who he didn't have a very high opinion of. We heard about Gordon stopping an uprising, and he convinced the slavers to actually work for his administration, and he walks right into their camp unarmed. Shortly after that, he tries to broker a peace between Egypt and Abyssinia, and he fails. He gets imprisoned, and then he's forced to admit failure, basically. And his failure in what he wanted to do, because he wanted to reform everything in the Sudan, But he was really working against the establishment. The Arabs didn't want to change, basically. The Ottomans didn't want to change. They wanted to keep slavery. And some of the Africans wanted to keep slavery as well. So every time that he would free these slaves, they would just get sold on again by people further up the administration. Incredibly corrupt, basically. The Third World administrations are incredibly corrupt. So he went back to Britain, had a bit of a nervous breakdown, and then he went to China again, but this time without British permission. And the British said, well, look, you've got to come back because there could be an international diplomatic incident if you resign your British citizenship and go fighting for the Chinese against the Russians. So he then comes back to Britain. He goes over to Ireland and is horrified to see the level of poverty that there is in Ireland. And he campaigns to change the system in Ireland. And he basically says that the British Empire should pay for all the lands that the Anglo-Irish have got there and give them back to the Irish. And he compares that to the British Empire buying the slaves from all the slave masters. And he says that this would solve all the problems that we have in Ireland. And he was correct, because after that, we did get the partition and we've had the troubles and everything else. And he also fell out with Prime Minister Gladstone over this, because he highlighted the fact that Gladstone actually came from a family that owned slaves. And he was saying, well, look, your family were bailed out for this. So they were paid for this and the slaves were given their freedom. Why don't you do the same in Ireland? Why don't you do the same and set these poor Irish free? And Gladstone was not very happy about that. And of course, this highlights the fact that in Britain, we were more concerned about how black slaves were treated in America than we actually were about how white slaves, essentially white slaves, were treated in Britain. Is there anything else you want to add to that, Max, that you remember from last week or want to?
No, I think that's a good summary, actually.
Okay, well,
it just shows Gordon as being a top guy, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, he really is. He's a real hero of the Empire, I think, a real archetypal British Empire man. Well, in the year 1881, which was the Islamic year 1298, to mark the coming of the new century, the self-proclaimed Mahdi, Mohammed Ahmed, announced that he was the Mahdi, a messianic figure in Islam which tradition holds will appear at the dawn of every new Islamic century to strike down the enemies of Islam. And this Mahdi pronounced a jihad against the Egyptian state. The long exploitation of the Sudan by Egypt led many Sudanese to rally to the Mahdi's black banner as he promised to expel the Egyptians, who Ahmed denounced as apostates. And before announcing that he would establish an Islamic fundamentalist state, marking a return to the pure Islam, said to have been practiced in the days that Muhammad lived in Arabia. So I'll just stop there, because there's a lot there. He's using exactly the same black banner as ISIS used today. It's exactly the same terminology as ISIS used today. And back then it was against the Ottomans, who have alcohol legal and they're fairly Western. And today we've got them doing the same thing against Syria, which again is fairly Westernized. They don't make people wear the veil. You can buy alcohol there. They're fairly secular. So the same thing is happening today as was happening back then. The only difference is today that we haven't actually got a self-proclaimed Mahdi, which they did back then. So to think that today we had no idea that was coming from Islam is a nonsense, because this is only 140 years ago. We had exactly the same situation happening in Egypt. Do you want to add anything to that?
People say that if we don't learn from history, then history will repeat itself. And what this demonstrates is that from the 1800s, or since the 1800s, we haven't learned from history as far as Islam is concerned.
No, we've learned nothing from history, or our leaders apparently have learned nothing from it. I think we as nationalists, we certainly have learned from it. Additionally, Baring's policy of raising taxes to pay off the debts that Ismail had run up had sparked much resentment in both Egypt and the Sudan. And remember last week, Gordon had come up with a plan to prevent all of this from happening, to prevent all this civil unrest from happening. He said, can Baring's Bank, can you hold off on the debt for a certain amount of time and we'll just pay a little bit off and then we'll pay the interest off? But Baring's said, no, we can't have that. And the result of that is now this Islamic unrest. In 1882, nationalist rage in Egypt against Baring's economic policies led to the revolt by Colonel Urabi Pasha, which was then put down by British troops. From September 1882 onwards, Egypt was a de facto British protectorate, effectively ruled by Baring from the bank. Though in theory, Egypt remained an Ottoman province with a very wide degree of autonomy until 1914. With Egypt under British rule, the British also inherited the problems of Egypt's colony, the Sudan, which the Egyptians were fast losing control of, to the Mahdi. After losing many battles and the destruction of an army, the Liberal Prime Minister, William Gladstone, decided that the Sudan was not worth the trouble it would take to hang on to, and as such it was to be abandoned to the Mahdi. In December 1883, the British government ordered Egypt to abandon the Sudan, but that was difficult to carry out as it involved the withdrawal of thousands of Egyptian soldiers, civilian employees, and their families. And again, I'll just stop there. I mean, it's like today when the IMF loan out all this money to the third world and they can't pay it back. And they say, well, you've got to change all your policies. You've got to change all your taxing. You've got to promote homosexuality. You've got to promote transgenderism. This is the sort of thing they say in the EU in particular, in order to get money. And basically it was just a lot more naked back then. You've actually got this Baring's bank, the de facto rulers of Egypt, because of these debts that they managed to get the head of Egypt to run up. I mean, it's really irresponsible banking, basically. But I think that, yeah, you know, that's the reason why they do it. It's the same as what when they give out mortgages to people that can't pay them back. It means that the bank can then repossess the house. The bank has created the money. It hasn't cost them anything to create the money. It's cost them nothing at all to print it or put the thing on the balance sheet there. But then once it can't be paid back, then they have actually got physical property that the bank then owns. So it's made physical property out of loaning out this money. And the same thing here. You got Baring's Bank taking over an entire country because they irresponsibly loaned out money to the head of the country. And of course, it's very tempting to say, well, that's the deliberate policy. That's why they have done that, is so that they can take over the country. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
It's what people would call financial imperialism, isn't it? It's the creation of an empire through the manipulation of money and lending irresponsibly, lending to people that, where you know that they haven't got the ability to repay the loan, is usury. And so it would appear that Baring's Bank were up to their armpits in usury at that time. And again, it's another lesson that the current leaders of the West have failed to recognize.
Well, yeah, I mean, the bank crash in 2008, that was caused by all these home loans to people that couldn't pay them back in America. Yep. We regularly get these economic crashes like that. And again, we can see that this was happening 140 years ago. We knew all of this, and yet it's still going on today. And we've got another bit coming up now, which is the same as today, and that's media manipulation. While staying with his sister in Southampton, Gordon received an unexpected visitor, namely William Thomas Stead, the editor of the Pall Mall Gazette, with whom Gordon reluctantly agreed to do an interview. He wanted to talk about the Congo, where he had been asked to go by King Leopold II, but Stead kept on pressing him to talk about the Sudan. Finally, after much prompting on Stead's part, Gordon opened up and attacked Gladstone's Sudan policy, coming out in favour of an intervention to crush the Mahdi. Gordon offered up a 19th century anticipation of the domino theory, claiming, "The danger arises from the influence which the spectacle of a conquering Mohammedan power established close to your frontiers will exercise upon the population which you govern. In all the cities of Egypt, it will be felt that what the Mahdi has done, they may do, and as he has driven out the intruder, they may do the same." I mean, these are wise words that he's saying here. He's saying that if you allow this to take place, the countries around will follow and do the same thing. Well, Stead published his interview on the 9th of January 1884 on the front page of the Pall Mall Gazette, alongside the editorial he had written entitled "Chinese Gordon for the Sudan." Urban wrote, "With this leader, William Stead's real motive in going to Southampton revealed itself at last. As to who tipped him off that the general would be staying here for just a couple of nights, we can only speculate." So he's also implying here that that Gladstone is in Southampton to see Gordon. Well, Stead's interview caused a media sensation and led to a popular clamour for Gordon to be sent to the Sudan. Urban wrote, "The Pall Mall Gazette articles, in short, began a new chapter in international relations, powerful men using media manipulations of public opinion to trigger war. It is often suggested that the campaign by William Randolph Hearst's paper that led to the US invasion of Cuba in 1898 was the world's first episode of this kind, but the British press deserves these dubious laurels for its actions a full 14 years earlier. The man behind the campaign was the Adjutant General Sir Garnet Wolseley, a skilled media manipulator who often leaked information to the press to effect changes in policy, and who was strongly opposed to Gladstone's policy of pulling out of the Sudan." So Gordon's being used as a bit of a puppet there by the media. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Just really to say that I agree entirely with your interpretation of the facts as presented.
Right, so again, it's the same today, isn't it? With the babies in the incubators is the excuse for the Iraq war, and this is the first time that this actually happened, and it was the press that was manipulating Gordon in order to do this, rather than actually the government that were wanting to go to war in the Sudan. It was the press, it was the mainstream media. Again, tie that in today, the immense power that the press have. They were really starting to flex their muscles back here at this time in 1884. With public opinion demanding that Gordon be sent to the Sudan, on the 16th of January 1884, the Gladstone government decided to send him there, albeit with a very limited mandate, to report on the situation and advise on the best means of carrying out the evacuation. Gladstone had gone to his estate at Hawarden to recover from an illness, and thus was not present at the meeting on the 18th of January when Gordon was given the Sudan command. But he was under the impression that Gordon's mission was an advisory one, whereas the four ministers present at the meeting had given Gordon the impression that his mission was executive in nature. Gladstone felt that this was a deft political move. Public opinion would be satisfied with Chinese Gordon going to the Sudan, but at the same time, Gordon was given such a limited mandate that the evacuation would proceed as planned. The cabinet felt very uncomfortable with the appointment, as they had been pressured by the press to send a man who was opposed to their Sudan policy to take command in the Sudan, with the Foreign Secretary Lord Grenville wondering if they had just committed a gigantic folly. So we do have a recipe for disaster here, don't we? Gordon thinks that Absolutely. He's in charge, and Gladstone thinks he's been told that he's just there as an advisor. So again, I'm wondering who's really behind the scenes here that really wants him to go out there, because the press, the press aren't the puppet masters, are they? They're just a tool that is actually used in this. We can't really see who it is that was wanting this to happen. Perhaps it was to do with the banks. It
could just have been people who had a desire to see the British Empire expand to its fullest, effectively, and to take in all disputed territories. It could be as simple as that. To some extent, I think that you can see that there are parallels between what was happening in the Sudan then and what has happened in Afghanistan more recently, and you can see that there are people in Pakistan who see what goes on in Afghanistan, and they see the way that the Taliban are effectively running rings around the British and the American soldiers that have been dispatched to Afghanistan. Those elements within Pakistan then become more militant against the Pakistani government, etc. And who knows that could have a domino effect of the sort that Gordon feared would occur in the Sudan.
Well, it's actually
to Egypt.
It's actually the same logic was applied to Adolf Hitler and National Socialism. We can't allow this to take off. We can't allow the rest of Europe to see the improvements that they've actually made in Germany. This has to be nipped in the bud. I mean, they prevented the Strength Through Joy ships from actually docking in Britain and other countries because they didn't want the inhabitants of Britain to see the high standard of living that these workers had and that they were having paid holidays on these ships. And that was the logic for going to war in Germany, was we can't allow the rest of Europe to do the same, basically. And, yeah. you know, you've got the same happening here. Well, Gordon started for Cairo in January 1884, accompanied by Lieutenant Colonel J.D. H. Stewart. At Cairo, he received further instructions from Sir Evelyn Baring and was appointed Governor General with executive powers by the Khedive Tewfik Pasha, who also gave Gordon a firman, an edict, ordering him to establish a government in the Sudan, which Gordon was later to use as a reason for staying in Khartoum. So again, we've got a bit of a contradiction here. The Ottomans have given him an executive powers, but I should imagine that Baring was, opposed to that. Baring disapproved of sending Gordon to the Sudan, writing in a report to London that a man who habitually consults the prophet Isaiah when he is in a difficulty is not apt to obey the orders of anyone. Gordon immediately confirmed Baring's fears as he started to issue press statements attacking the rebels as a feeble lot of stinking dervishes and demanded he be allowed to smash up the Mahdi. Gordon sent a telegram to Khartoum reading, "Don't be panic-stricken. Ye are men, not women. I am coming, Gordon." So Gordon's really starting to have a bit of fun here. He realises he's been played by the press and he's decided he's going to play them, basically.
So well, this is kind of where Gordon is a bit of a loose cannon, isn't he? He's somebody with a lot of a big ego and a lot of personal ambition as well, I think, and wants to see a job done properly. If he's going to put his name to a job, he wants it to be done well and properly his way, not to do it half-heartedly according to somebody else's micromanaged orders.
Yeah, he is certainly an individual. Well, Urban wrote that Gordon's most stupid mistake occurred when he revealed his secret orders at a meeting of tribal leaders on the 12th of February at Berber, explaining that the Egyptians were pulling out, leaving to almost all of the Arab tribes of northern Sudan declaring their loyalty to the Mahdi. Given that Gordon himself, in his interview with Stead, had stated, "The moment it is known that we have given up the game, every man will go over to the Mahdi," his decision to reveal that the Egyptians were pulling out remains inexplicable. Shortly afterwards, Gordon wrote what Urban called a bizarre letter to the Mahdi, telling him to accept the authority of the Khedive of Egypt and offering him the chance to work as one of Gordon's provincial governors. The Mahdi contemptuously rejected Gordon's offer and sent back a letter demanding that Gordon convert to Islam. And basically what Gordon's doing here is he's doing the same thing that he did last time. When he went into the slavers and he went there unarmed and he said, "I'm the man in charge. You will respect my authority. And if you lay down your weapons, we'll take you on in the administration." And what he's basically doing here is he's doing the same thing. He's done exactly the same thing to the Mahdi, but the Mahdi is a religious extremist. So it's not going to work on him this time. The Mahdi ended his letter with the remark, "I am the expected Mahdi and I do not boast. I am the successor of God's prophet and I have no need of any sultanate of Kordofan or anywhere else." Even Wolseley had cause to regret sending Gordon, as Gordon revealed himself to be a loose cannon whose press statements attacking the liberal government were obstructing rather than furthering his plans to take over the Sudan. Travelling through Corsoco and Berber, he arrived at Khartoum on the 18th of February, where he offered his earlier foe, the slaver king Rahama Zobia, release from prison in exchange for leading troops against Ahmed. Gordon's attempt to have his former arch-enemy Zobia, the king of the slavers, whom he had hunted for years and whose son he had executed, installed as the new Sultan of the Sudan, appalled Gladstone and offended his former admirers in the anti-slavery society. And he is going a little bit off piste here, I think. You got any comments on this, Max?
Well, I think I have to agree with you. I think that they describe in the text Gordon as a loose cannon, and I've described him as a bit of a loose cannon earlier on. And I think it's he's perhaps become a little bit strong-headed and carried away with his own view of himself as an adventurer and a king-making adventurer, I suppose. That's perhaps the best way to describe him. And so here he is, not actually pursuing these adventures for his own financial gain, but pursuing these adventures for just the sheer thrill and the glory of doing it.
Yeah, I think that's it. It's for the glory, isn't it? It's certainly not for financial gain. I mean, he only takes like 10% of the wages. He gives 90% away to charity. After arriving in Khartoum, Gordon announced that on the grounds of honour, he would not evacuate Khartoum, but rather would hold the city against the Mahdi. He was well received by a crowd of about 9,000 during his return, where the crowd continually chanted, "Father" and "Sultan." Gordon assured the people of Khartoum in a speech delivered in his rough-hewn Arabic that the Mahdi was coming with his army of Islam marching under their black banners, but to have no fear, as here he would be stopped. Gordon had a garrison of about 8,000 soldiers armed with Remington rifles, together with a colossal ammunition dump containing millions of rounds. He commenced the task of sending the women, children, sick and wounded to Egypt, and about 2,500 people had been removed before the Mahdi's forces started closing in on Khartoum. Gordon hoped to have the influential local leader, Sebir Rahma, appointed to take control of Sudan, but the British government refused to support a former slaver. During this time in Khartoum, Gordon befriended the Irish journalist Frank Powers, who was the Times London correspondent in the Sudan. Powers was delighted that the charismatic Gordon had no anti-Catholic prejudices and treated him as an equal. The hero-worshipping Powers wrote about Gordon, "He is indeed, I believe, the greatest man of this century." Gordon granted Powers privileged access, and in return, Powers started to write a series of popular articles for the Times depicting Gordon as the solitary hero taking on a vast horde of fanatical Muslims. Gordon made all of his personal dispatches to London public. There was no official Secrets Act at the time. In his attempts to win public opinion over to his policy, writing on one dispatch, "Not secret as far as I'm concerned." At one point, Gordon suggested in a telegram to Gladstone that the notoriously corrupt Ottoman Sultan Abdul Hamid II could be bribed into sending 3,000 Ottoman troops for the relief of Khartoum, and if the British government was unwilling or unable to pay that amount, he was certain that either Pope Leo XIII or a group of American millionaires would be. And he's really having some fun here. He's really like getting his own back on the government here, I think, from what he's seeing, some of the worst things that he's seeing going on with the banks and the British Empire. But Gordon decided to stay and hold Khartoum despite the orders of the Gladstone government to merely report about the best means of supervising the evacuation of the Sudan. Powers, who acted as Gordon's unofficial press attaché, wrote in the Times, "We are daily expecting British troops. We cannot bring ourselves to believe that we are to be abandoned." In his diary, Gordon wrote, "I own to having been very insubordinate to Her Majesty's government and its officials, but it is my nature, and I cannot help it. I fear I have not even tried to play battledore and shuttlecock with them. I know if I was chief, I would never employ myself, for I am incorrigible."
That's fantastic.
He's great, isn't he? Because of public opinion, the government dared not sack Gordon, but the cabinet was extremely angry about his insubordination, with many privately saying if Gordon wanted to defy orders by holding Khartoum, then he only deserved what he was going to get. Gladstone himself took Gordon's attacks on his Sudan policy very personally, and one cabinet minister wrote, "The London newspapers and the Tories clamour for an expedition to Khartoum. The former from ignorance, the latter because it is the best model of embarrassing us. Of course, it is not an impossible undertaking, but it is melancholy to think of the waste of lives and the treasure which it must involve." The cabinet itself was divided and confused about just what to do about the Sudan crisis, leading to a highly dysfunctional style of decision-making. Because his Turkish, Egyptian and many of his Sudanese troops were Muslim, Gordon refrained in public from describing his battle with the Mahdi as a religious war, but Gordon's diary showed he viewed himself as a Christian champion, fighting against the Mahdi just as much for God as for Queen and country. The Mahdi and his followers had been fighting a jihad since 1881 and looked forward to taking on the famous General Gordon as a chance to win glory for Allah. Gordon energetically organised the defence of Khartoum right from the moment he arrived there, using his training as a military engineer to turn the city into a fortress. Additionally, Gordon had guns and armoured plating attached to the paddle wheel steamers stationed at Khartoum to create his own private riverine navy that served as an effective force against the Ansar. The Turkish troops at Khartoum were not part of the Ottoman army, but rather the Bashi Bazooks, the irregulars whom Gordon commented were good for raids, but useless for battle. The Shagiyya, one of the few Arab tribes who did not rally to the Mahdi, drove Gordon to distraction, with Gordon writing in his diary about them, "Dreadful lot, how I look forward to their disbandment." Gordon had a low opinion of the Egyptian, Turkish and Arab Sudanese troops under his command, whom he constantly disparaged as a mutinous, badly disciplined and ill-trained rabble, good only for looting. But he had a much higher opinion of his black Sudanese soldiers. Most of them were former slaves who would rather die fighting as free men than live as slaves again. It was well known that the Mahdi's forces were going to enslave the blacks of Khartoum once they took the city. The black Sudanese troops, many from what is now South Sudan, proved to be Gordon's best troops at Khartoum, and they numbered about 2,300. And after that, we get into the siege. Have you got any comments you'd like to make on that, Max?
Oh, well, just read. His story is turning into a kind of Indiana Jones kind of adventure, isn't it?
Yeah, you can see why they made a film out of it. You know, they made a film out of the siege of Khartoum. Because all these events that went on, and he's led a really exciting life, basically. And I think he knows that this is where he's going to go out in a blaze of glory. And he's going to have a lot of fun while doing it as well, especially with these dispatches to the Times. And you can imagine the British public are just waiting to read the next newspaper and read the next missive from Gordon, who's out there surrounded by these crazy Muslims. And and the public are all behind him, and they're saying, you know, you've got to go out there and rescue Gordon. You've got to go out there and fight the Muslims. And Gladstone is like, oh no, you know, we can't possibly do that. Think of the money that it's going to cost. And the Tories at the same time, they're going for Gladstone as well. And Gordon's having the time of his life. I mean, he really is the center of attention here, and he's really getting a chance to mock the government and the people that he felt should have done better. And when you think about it, the advice that he's given all along this time has been correct. The advice that he gave in China, that they needed to treat the Han Chinese better. The advice that he gave them again about making peace and not going to war against Russia. The advice that he was giving the Ottomans about stopping the floggings and treating their people better. All the way along, he's been given good advice. And all the way along, he's been let down by his superiors. They've all turned out to be corrupt or to be more interested in the money than actually the people that they're supposed to be governing. And I think he sees this as his chance to defend the little man. I mean, that's how he sees these blacks. He's, because they're former slaves, they're right at the bottom of the pecking order, and Gordon is going to prevent them from being enslaved by the Islamic State. And I think that's the true British spirit there, is to look after those of you who are smaller. The big man looks after the smaller man. He doesn't oppress the smaller man. And Gordon is that example, I think.
I think to an extent, Gordon perhaps has become disenchanted with government and with following government orders. And he's kind of in a place now. And the African continent presented itself as an enormous playground, I think, to people of Gordon's caliber at that particular time, because he could have just gone back to some ordinary pen pushing job where the rest of his life would have been boring and he would have achieved nothing. But Africa presented him with the opportunity to, as you say, go out in a blaze of glory and to have a rollicking adventure that people would remember for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years thereafter, you know, where he was a kind of Indiana Jones character, scraping together the sort of forces that he could possibly find, many of which were unreliable, and pitting himself against, you know, what he saw as the religious enemy, the Mahdi and the Muslims, and fighting a Christian war on his own terms, effectively.
Yeah, I mean, this was the great battle of the times. You got the religious aspect to it there as well, the Christian against the Islamic army. You've got the big guy looking out for the little guy, and then you've got all the British public waiting on tenderhooks to read his next message that's been sent out from Khartoum, because as we'll hear next week, he gets under siege, basically, and that's the name of the movie, The Siege of Khartoum.
And just say before we finish, it's almost like being a film star, in the sense that you are like the last action hero, as sort of portrayed by Arnold Schwarzenegger, but instead of his adventures being on the silver screen, his adventures were actually lived in real life.
Well, yeah, you wonder how many other characters there are like this in the British Empire. I mean, this presented the chance for that to happen. And as we've shown, you had people that, you know, worked their way up from being absolutely nothing to being the governors of these countries. And they had these battles, they had all these intrigues. I mean, it was an amazing time to be a young British man, I think, in the time of the British Empire. Well, we'll leave it there, I think, today. Thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.